RN. Follow us on Twitter at Radio National.
Hello and welcome. This is Life Matters and I'm Cassie McCullough. In a moment, the secret life of stuff. All the things we own, we care for, we lug from home to home. And the not-so-little things, plasma TVs, furniture, tools, kooky impulse buys. Novelist Kate Veitch has written an essay called Why Do We Own So Much Stuff? She says we're constantly accumulating possessions and at the same time trying to declutter. Keen to hear from you this morning. Do you wage battle against material objects or do you adore the things you have around you that give meaning to your life? Also, have you been sucked in when you fill out those consumer satisfaction surveys? The uncanny marketing objectives behind those innocent surveys asking you to give feedback on a service you've received or a product you've bought. You might be surprised by the real motivation of these proliferating questionnaires. And a secret sound on Life Matters today. What's this? Can you picture it? You probably can. We'll find out what it is a little bit later on Life Matters. Less is more was the central design principle of the great 20th century architect Mies van der Rohe. The phrase has been used and abused ever since it was uttered. It's become a mantra for interior designers, decluttering gurus and fashion icons. So why then do we have so much stuff? Many of us are drowning in it. Cupboards and wardrobes bulging at the seams. So much stuff, so many choices, so many decisions. Novelist Kate Veitch wonders why we're all so busy accumulating far more than we can use while at the same time yearning for a home devoid of clutter. She's written an essay about her relationship with stuff in the latest Griffith Review. It's called Why Do We Own So Many Things? And she's joining us now from Bali. G'day, Kate.
Hi, Cassie. How are you?
Well, thanks. Now, tell us, you describe your relationship to stuff in this article. What's your home filled with?
Oh, far too much. In fact, the essay came about partly because two good friends separately came to visit me who hadn't seen me in my home there, sent from interstate, and both of them happened to look around and said something like, "Do you think you could fit anything more in?" And it made me look at the place with new eyes and think, there is rather a lot of stuff, isn't there? And yet, when I looked around, I knew the provenance of every single object. And I love them. I love all of the little carved dogs and the textiles that I've bought here and there. I love all of the vases. My grandmother taught me you can never have too many vases.
I understand you have a weakness for small figurines of dogs.
Well, they can be small, they can be large. I do. I have a special attachment to the objet de dog. However, after I had counted them in the room that I write in and realised that there were, well, over 40, I really did think, okay, it's time for some of my doggies to go and have a little lie down and a rest. So there are fewer around me now. But that's the thing. I'm interested in, just as you said, the relationships that we have with our stuff. I'm not someone who takes a point of view that, you know, too much stuff is bad, get rid of it. It's not as simple as that. It really is a complex thing. We form relationships with the material things that we own because of our associations with them. Now, that's one reason to have a lot of stuff. Of course, there's also the fact that we just do accumulate things for perhaps less personal or noble, shall we say, reasons. like status, showing that we've got the latest gadgets, like demonstrations of our good taste, and by the simple inability to move that old toaster on after we've got the one that actually works.
We're talking with Kate Veach, who's written an essay, Why We Own So Many Things. Do you keep stuff that other people would throw out? Are you a bit of a collector slash hoarder? And why is that? I mean, some people find it lovely to be surrounded by little objects in a room full of things that the eye can rest on. Others would like a white plain wall and just one or two ornaments. Give us a call, 1300 225 76 1300 call. RN. You touch on an interesting piece of, well, I guess it's a very sad part of our recent history, Kate, in this essay, and that's the American experience of homes that had been bought in with the collapse of the GFC.
Yes, and the housing market.
That's right. There's mortgages that were, you know, pretty dodgy, and many people weren't able to keep up with them in that period. And you describe someone walking into those places and finding stuff.
Oh, yeah. So I have a friend in the States where I spent a lot of time. He's what they call there a realtor. We call just a real estate agent. So as he lives in a, you know, what was a prosperous town in California, medium-sized town. It's still doing okay. Nevertheless, that housing bubble, when it broke, affected everywhere, absolutely everywhere. So he was called upon to assess many, many houses. In walking into many of them, in the States you can just walk away. You can just leave it and walk away. They don't pursue you for the debt. The bank resumes the house. So these people had walked away, and when he came into many of them, he found them from the front door to the back in every single room, piled with stuff. And these were things that had been bought largely online or from what they call their big box stores. You know, there was ski equipment, for people who live hundreds, thousands of miles from the ski field. There were plasma TVs not even out of their wrappers. When he spoke to me about it, it was shocking and moving, really, to hear him describe this situation where people had been encouraged to place value on their lives through nothing else but the stuff that they own.
So while they couldn't pay their mortgage repayments, they were still spending big on things.
And still being offered new credit cards. Still being offered more credit on which to buy. Mm. I mean, these people dug themselves a pit with a plastic card that they could not climb out of. And they were encouraged to do so by a society that wants people, needs people, will collapse if people don't keep buying more stuff, whether they want it, whether they need it or not. And it definitely does become a compulsion personally, precisely because it's a compulsion for the capitalist society. Mm. What would happen if we stopped buying new stuff?
We're talking with Kate Veach about why we own so many things. Susan has a story to tell. She's in the ACT. G'day, Susan.
Suzanne. Hi, Cassie. How are you?
Well, thanks. Yes, you've got an unhealthy relationship.
Well, I think I do. I just love acquiring all this bric-a-brac. I don't know about my book thing. I have many, many books, many too many books. I don't see that as unhealthy as I see the bric-a-brac compulsion, and it is a compulsion, I think it goes right back, because I was just saying to the person that first answered the phone, I can remember I was a little girl going off to boarding school, and I said to my grandmother, I need all this stuff, and it was like scissors, paper clips, office equipment, which I, of course, didn't need at all, but I wanted it. I needed it somehow.
So it gave you a sense of home and a sense of stability or something?
Oh, I don't know, maybe some sort of security, yes. Now, this is really maybe a weird theory of mine, but I think it possibly dates back to the fact that my mother absented herself very early in my life. I don't know, but I do think it's an unhealthy habit I have. And the only way I can beat it really is to avoid op shops and, you know, curio shops and so forth.
That is hard. That is very hard.
It is hard. It's really hard. And I'm really in my element in those places, wandering around finding things. But, yes, it's strange. And, you know, about time I started avoiding them, I think, for a while, because I, you know, come home with all this stuff.
Well, thank you, Suzanne, especially for reminding us that we mustn't judge people for accumulating things. There are many reasons for it, of course. Paul, also in the ACT, you've got a sister who helps you out every now and again.
Yes, she's got a philosophy. She said she was bound by her possessions and couldn't move out of Tasmania to Melbourne when she did go. So she decided that she hadn't used an object for 12 months. That was out the door, and including the husband. So,
wow, that's radical.
Safe to say, he's still intact.
So. Well, that's good to hear. Yeah. Okay, so a 12-month turnover, a kind of annual report on
that's
yourself.
It. That's the one. Okay.
Thanks for that, Paul. Kate, part of this, you were talking there about the encouragement from the external world to buy stuff, and you write in your essay about George Bush right after 9/11 saying, I encourage you to go shopping, get down to Disney World in Florida, take your family, enjoy life. So it was a call to arms, go shopping.
It literally, go shopping, that's exactly right, yeah. And I think that this phenomenon of having more stuff than we need is something that previous generations, unless they were very wealthy, did not have. Prior really to the Second World War, when there was this massive escalation of manufacturing capacity in order to meet the war needs, followed by the boom years, it is a baby boomer phenomenon really, that even people who are not wealthy can and often do accumulate far more stuff than we need. Now, perhaps through the millennia of human development, we would have always been drowning in stuff. Certainly rich people didn't leave austere lives way back, did they? They loved to have all of their stuff. But now we can too, and we don't really quite know what to do with it. We're encouraged on so many levels, as you say, to, you know, get out there and go shopping. That's what our society, our value, our worth is all about. And yet, listening to Suzanne's story of the bric-a-brac, my heart really goes out to her, because even though she loves the things, I sense that she feels burdened by them. And this was a word that came up when I was researching this essay, which did have a serious intent. The edition of Griffith Review that I wrote it for is called Fixing the System, and it's about how we fix the system. Can we fix the system that is breaking, if not broken? When I researched this whole issue of material ownership among friends, the word burden came up so many times. People have this real seesaw relationship with the things that they own, that they love them, but they feel burdened by them. One friend said that every time he tries to get rid of the beautiful things that he owns, because he has too many, every time he tries to cull them, he finds it impossible. And so he continues surrounded by them, feeling both love and a sense of being burdened. It's quite a conundrum, and I'm not talking here about the the real OCD, obsessive compulsive disorder of true hoarding, where people are hemmed into their houses by you know, stacks of newspapers 40 years old. I'm just talking about regular clutter reaching a proportion that we're no longer happy with.
You do describe, just finally, Kate, this scene, this quite awful scene when you kind of discovered one of your lifelong friends in a... You describe it as being like Gollum in the movies, the Lord of the Ring movies. Tell us that about that story.
This was a friend who never bought new things. She lived in Oregon. She'd moved there from Australia many years ago. And she never bought new things. She was what she proudly described as a dumpster diver in her work. She had the capacity to travel with a truck. And so she rescued things. That was how she saw it. But they had gradually taken over her life. She had containers full of it at her beach house. She forbade me on my last visit there from going down to the basement. And when I did, when there was someone at the door for her, I glimpsed her perched atop a meter-deep mound of clothing and shoes and heaven knows what else. And it was a frightful moment. She really did look like a creature possessed by her possessions. And she saw the look on my face, and that really was the end of our friendship. She cut it from there on. That was a friendship that had gone back to childhood. Mm. It was a choice between confronting her relationship with the things that had taken over her life or cutting off someone who had witnessed it, really.
Yeah. You say that she cut the rope on that friendship, which was a great expression.
Yeah. For most of us, it's a lot healthier than that. And I will say this, despite my great love for and attachment to the things that I own, and specifically the memories that they have stored within them, I have never spoken to anyone who did a big cull and who now lives with less stuff who isn't very happy with that.
Well, there you go. There's your take-home message. Thanks so much for talking with us today, Kate.
Thank you.
That's novelist Kate Veitch. She's the author of an essay in the latest Griffith Review called Stuff, Why Do We Own So Many Things? She's also the author of two novels, Listen and Trust, which are both published by Penguin. And she was talking to us from Bali, actually, but she normally lives in New South Wales. Coming up next, Adam Ferrier. You might know his face from the Gruen transfer. He's a consumer behavioural specialist, and he's going to tell us about the truth behind those little surveys that we often do for companies.
Out now from ABC DVD. Take home the 12th and final series of the much-loved crime classic, New Tricks. Follow the drama as five co-workers win the lottery in The Syndicate. Explore six of the world's most alluring cities in Metropolis and unlock the secrets of the world's most iconic engineering feats in Time Scanners. All the hottest new DVD releases available now. In store at ABC centres, on mobile and online at abcshop.com.au.
Have you ever been asked for your feedback? Have you been asked for it recently? Maybe an email with that perky subject line, how did we do? It might be a follow-up on a phone call you've had with an internet service provider or a financial institution. They'll often give you the name of an employee that served you. Were you satisfied with their service? Can you rate it from 1 to 10? How likely are you to recommend the company to your family and friends? Well, I'm a total sucker for these. I often filled them out, particularly when it's about a particular employee, because I sort of think somehow I'm responsible for their future career trajectory. I was recently given a survey on a clipboard after seeing a doctor at a medical clinic, and I did actually fill it out because I thought the way this practice is run could be improved and maybe my input would be useful. But it's dawned on me that maybe my feedback's never used at all. In fact, this might be part of a sophisticated consumer behaviour technique. Adam Ferrier is a consumer psychologist, the Global Chief Strategy Officer and Partner at Cummins and Partners, and he also wrote a book called The Advertising Effect, How to Change Behaviour. G'day, Adam.
Hey, how are you?
Well, am I a total sucker?
Yeah, unlike your previous lovely guest, the novelist who was complaining about getting people to have less stuff, I actually try to encourage people to have more stuff.
This is your evil day job.
That's right. And part of all these surveys and forms you've been filling out is indeed a very clever way to get you to buy more stuff or have a stronger relationship with all of these various institutions who you're filling out these forms for.
Okay, so how does that work?
How it works is there's a technique in advertising called the Hawthorne effect. The Hawthorne effect basically says if you're ever researched on anything, you become more positively predisposed to the thing that did the research, regardless of your ingoing kind of relationship with that thing. So just by having your opinion asked for and investing a little bit of time and effort into that thing, then you will like that entity even more. So we have, and this is going to get a little bit confusing, we have thoughts, feelings and actions. Those three things have to be aligned or else we experience cognitive dissonance, if anyone remembers that from first year psychology. As soon as you act towards something, you change your thoughts and feelings to make sense of that action. So you're filled in a survey, therefore you say to yourself, I like this place because I've taken the time and effort to fill in this survey.
Sounds like a mild form of the Stockholm syndrome where hostages learn to love their captors. But look,
Done well it is.
Yes, at the very top end. So here I have a few of my recent emails. Hello, on January 20, Giselle assisted you with your query. We understand that it may not be fully resolved, but could you please fill out a short survey? So that's one. Then another one, how likely would you be to recommend XYZ service to your friends and colleagues? Colleagues is new. They go on and on. There's one for a theatre show I saw. There's one for a cosmetic that I bought. They want me to rate it. Actually, that one also wants me to write a review. So maybe they're... strategies a little bit more transparent
And more sophisticated as well, probably, because they're asking you to invest even more of yourself into the brand. So if you wrote a review, you're spending more time and effort. Therefore, that process of having internal cognitive alignment will mean you like it even more if you bother to fill out the review. So the more effort you put in to the form or the whatever it is, then the more the effect works, the stronger you're going to like that thing.
So my awareness of it, I've invested in it. Mm-hmm. I'm part of their future success because I've worked towards Giselle's improved customer service.
That's right. There's an interesting study that looked at open rates of emails, and promotional emails, so just an email with a promotional message on, gets opened at about 10 times less rate than an email that asks you to do something. So it kind of plays on our natural desire, if you like, to help or to express our opinion or to, you know.
Yeah, maybe it does just in appeal to my inflated sense of my own opinion.
You know what? It'll be really interesting to see. I don't know if you're narcissistic or not.
Quite possibly.
But I wonder if it does. I wonder if people who are a little bit more, who have a very strong sense of self-worth, they're more likely to fill out these surveys because they think their opinion is more important.
Or worse, maybe. Sometimes when I don't fill out one, I feel that I might have contributed to...
Oh, you've let them down.
<That's right. laughs>
They're missing out on your words of wisdom. Oh, no. What will happen?
Yeah, but often they do ask you to talk about whether you would recommend it to others. And that seems to me a very clever technique because instantly while you're in that space or thinking about that company, you're then associating it with people you love or care for.
That's right. Some years ago, I was involved with a campaign with a beverage company that came. It's a beverage that comes in a red can called Coke.
Oh yeah,
and you know the one. And we did a campaign called Share a Coke, and we encouraged everybody to buy a Coke with their friend's name on it. And it's the first time with a massive company like that asking you to buy a Coke for another person, kind of is that company opening up saying, hey, we need your help to promote this brand, which is kind of ridiculous. But every single time if you bought one for somebody else or you promoted it to somebody else, you're investing even more of yourself into the brand. There's a really interesting effect where it says the best way to get somebody to like you is to get that person to do you a favour. So if you can get somebody to do something for you then you're going to like that person even more, or that brand or that business even more, because you've done them a favour. So if you promote something to your friends, you really are investing something of yourself, of your own name, into that brand. Therefore, you're going to like that brand even more because you've done that action.
That is really strange, isn't it? Because being enlisted, I suppose that's a very powerful thing. When you feel needed, that your input is valued in that way.
I mean, if you ever go to a cult, or, you know, if you've ever been accosted by those personal development groups such as Landmark or any of those kind of things, the first thing they do is they get you to go and bring a whole lot of other people along. And by doing that, you have invested even more of yourself into that particular brand.
It's a kind of Ponzi scheme.
That's right.
Social capital.
That's right. And so if you take that, then every single form you fill out kind of works like a Ponzi scheme, but just on a very micro kind of level, if you like.
We're talking with Adam Ferrier. He's one of those evil people who tries to make you buy more stuff, but he's also the author of a book called The Advertising Effect, looking at consumer behaviour. Some of this information does get used, and it's actually very wide and varied, the way people, the companies use it and use this technique. But data has become increasingly important.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. So the byproduct of all of this kind of information they're getting from you, another reason why they're asking all these opinions is so that they can then gather data from you, and then they can use that data to create more effective messaging. And they'll understand what your relationship is like with that particular brand, as well as competitive brands perhaps, and then they can tailor messages much more effectively to you. The reason why I don't mind talking about this stuff, even though I'm being in advertising, is because I think the more informed people are about how all these things work, then the more they can react to it and use their kind of shift from kind of mindless consumption to mindful consumption, if you like, and actually be aware of the consumption decisions they're making and why they're doing this kind of stuff. So, I believe all these corporations have a right to promote themselves, and consumers have a need to be informed about how this stuff works.
Even if it makes your day job a bit harder. So they use that information, maybe sometimes even sell it. But the other powerful component in this kind of consumer interaction is social media, which is brand new. Advertising, I guess, is having a difficult time, or has been in recent decades, as the growth of online communities and life increases and television audiences fracture, and now we're changing our behaviours. It's harder to connect with certain parts of the community, and young people have always been difficult to catch. This must be part of that, breaking into a social media brand awareness.
Yeah, sort of. I mean, all advertising works in different ways. Most advertising, what we call passive advertising, one-way advertising, works via low involvement processing. So you don't even need to be aware, or you don't even need to see the ad. You don't even need to be aware that you've seen the ad for the ad to work. So you drive home, you get exposed to a whole lot of outdoor ads. You won't be able to recall any of them. All of those ads would have left an impression in your mind and will make you more likely to buy that particular thing versus its competitor when you go home. But in terms of social media and this interactive kind of stuff where you're getting people to promote messages on your behalf, it works much more effectively than low involvement processing does. But it all works, whether you like advertising or not, whether you think you watch TV or not, it still all works.
What about the risk in this kind of direct engagement with the customer? If you're asking a customer to rate something, that's a possibly dangerous proposition.
I don't think so. We did a study. We created a fictitious chocolate brand once. We got people to rate it. We got people to make a comment on it. And we got people to pass the message on. Whether the comment was positive or negative, they were still more likely to like that and buy that chocolate bar as a result of filling in a form or of making a comment, whether that comment was positive or negative. So again, just by interacting with the brand, even if you did it in a negative sense, you're still going to increase your likability towards that brand.
Okay, and so if I'm filling out at the bottom of the range, like 0 to 3, I'll never use this again, or I was totally dissatisfied, that's not a problem.
No, it's not. It's still going to move you from a 3 to a 4 for next time. It's still going to make you like the brand even more, even though you're spitting up vitriol about that particular brand.
We're funny creatures, aren't we? Mm-hmm. What about the increasing lifespan of us humans, the longevity of brand connections must be a factor that people are beginning to, well, probably not beginning to, they've probably been doing it since...
They've been doing it forever. We like to call it cradle-to-grave marketing, which is a wonderful term. And again, it's about if you can get this, if you can get the data, understand the consumer, understand their relationship with you as a particular brand, and also their trigger points along their life stage. So like when they're getting engaged, when they're getting married, when they're having kids, when the kids are going to school, and so on and so on and so on, then you can deliver more tailored messages to that people. There's also obviously things like loyalty schemes where you can give them more stuff and reward them for their loyalty over time. But in getting people when they're younger and having a long-term relationship with those consumers is obviously much more valuable than any one-off particular piece of one-off transaction, which makes getting the consumer incredibly valuable, which is why they're willing to spend so much money on that initial engagement because they want to get you and get their claws in and keep you.
Well, so what about how does that work with a company like Volkswagen, which has had some trouble recently with the emission rates on their diesel engines not being what they said they were and some trouble with the brakes, et cetera. That must be catastrophic for Volkswagen because people have long lives, long memories.
Yeah, no, I don't think so. I don't think that will be catastrophic at all because a brand is a cluster of ideas. So all the ideas you have about a particular brand kind of equal the totality of what that brand's about. The bigger that brand is, the more that brand's been around, the more ubiquitous it is, the more bulletproof it is, if you like, to bad things happening. So the brand of Volkswagen is massive in the consumer's mind. Mm. You think about it, there's loads and loads of associations that have been going on for years and years and years. In the mind, there's now one little blip that's called rip those testers off about the diesel thing. But it's such a small blip compared to all the other impressions that Volkswagen has put into your head over the years, and they'll continue to put a lot more impressions into your head that are not to do with that thing in the future. So I wouldn't be surprised if sales are already back to normal for Volkswagen.
Gus, when I think about it, it is such a myriad of images I have with that particular brand, from the fun-loving Beetle and Kombi to that German Precision and et cetera. Yeah. Look, it's fascinating, Adam. Will you come back and talk to us again about stuff?
Again and again and again.
Being mindful consumers, that's his mission. Thanks so much for talking with us today, Adam.
Good on you.
That's Adam Ferrier. He's the author of a book called The Advertising Effect, and also he is a part of a big company, and it's called Cummins and Partners, and he's going to come back and talk to us about ideas around what we're being sold, why, and how we can be more mindful about it. This is Life Matters, and I'm Cassie McCullough. Back in a moment.
Hi, Richard Ader here. Economics is known as the dismal science, and work as a necessary evil. Well, no and no. Economics is really about how everything connects with everything else. It's much more than supply and demand. It's about human behaviour. And work, well, it's demanding, it's involving, it's frustrating, can be exciting. It could well be part of your identity. The Money and Best Practice. Two shows, four broadcasts. For more details, look for the Red Radio on the RN homepage.
Well, you might remember our secret sound from a little earlier on. Of course, if you're listening closely, you would know that that was a roller coaster. How many times have you said that life is like a roller coaster? Metaphorically, it may well be for many of us. But for our next guest, his life really is all about roller coasters. Malcolm Burt is a roller coaster academic. Yes, he's undertaken a research project looking into the cultural function of these beasts of the fun park. He's just completed a documentary about why roller coasters exist. Here's a little of some of the voices that he interviewed, roller coaster enthusiasts from around the world, in his doco.
I love rides this much. If I could hug them, I would.
I think I care about roller coasters very deeply, perhaps too deeply.
My entire travel schedule, for the most part, is basically based on roller coasters.
I love roller coasters about as much as I love pizza, and I love pizza.
This is a wonderful ride. And to let it sit here and just decay is an obscenity.
What's the longest you've lined up for a ride?
Probably the 2 hours for Sky Rush, which I didn't even get on.
Did you ever regret having roller coasters tattooed over your body?
No, I have a couple other ones that I kind of regret, but not the roller coaster.
The voices of some roller coasters enthusiasts from around the world. Hello, Malcolm.
Good morning.
This is an odd obsession, I have to say, one I understand you've had for most of your life. But first, tell us, roller coasters are actually big business. I understand that Disney has created one that cost $100 million.
Absolutely, and that was a couple of years ago. They've moved on from there. So I think, you know, for anyone to sort of underestimate the impact of these rides and our societal need for them, just think, you know, that Disney, which is a pretty hardcore media company, spent $100 million on a ride. They were so sure that it was going to bring people in. I mean, that's kind of the beginning and the end of the argument there, really.
So the question is, why do people queue up, as we heard, sometimes for a long time, hours, to get on these things for what can only sometimes be a 90-second ride?
Well, exactly. I mean, that's the question I'm asking, that when you think about coasters, they make almost no sense at all, that they're located in parks that are a long way outside major urban centres, so it takes a long time to get there. The parks can be fiendishly expensive to get into, and it's quite normal to wait 2 hours for a 90-second ride to nowhere. No one thinks about this. And I think the more you think about that, the crazier it seems. So we do these things. And like you mentioned before, you know, it's entered our vernacular, the roller coaster stock market or our roller coaster cancer journey. They're just there. We, you know, we consume them, we refer to them, we don't think about them.
So what we're describing when we use that as an adjective is a feeling of a rush, then a stop and a
kind of ups and downs and out of control. I mean, yeah, you know what you're saying.
That sort of climbing up, dun, 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 as you're climbing up and then whoosh, down again.
good sounds. Nice.
Thank you. Now, theme parks were started way back in Europe, and it was a kind of rich person's, well, even the monarchy were involved in some parts of Europe in building them. Tell us a bit about that history.
I mean, ultimately, they began with rich people sort of opening up their castle grounds to the, you know, the poor people, the hoi polloi, to come along and see what life is like on the other side. And then it became quite popular, so they started introducing little amusements, and you know, and then these amusements became small rides, and then, you know, they started to charge for these rides, and, you know, from there, the concept of parks developed into, you know, the modern parks we have today. But the reason that parks kind of came around is ultimately based on capitalism. And this sounds a little ranty, but capitalism itself, it defined leisure time and it defined work time and non-work time, and the non-work time was leisure time. And then it set about commodifying that that non-work time. And that's really what's happened today. And then one of the reasons that parks are so successful nowadays is that we are in, you know, living under capitalism in a Western world in particular. We don't have much holiday time. We do live in what I lovingly call a lazy consumerist society. So we don't really have any way to access the extreme sensations that you can get on these rides safely. But in our compressed leisure time, you know, the small amount of holidays that we have, we want compressed excitement and compressed adventure. And of course, parks offer that because, you know, where else can you go around the world? You know, think of Disneyland. Where can you go around the world or multiple worlds in one day and experience a range of these extraordinary, extreme sensations? Well, you know, you really can't do it in 2 days unless you're going to drop $90 to go down to a park.
So it's a kind of manufactured thrill, some kind of like replication of a more primal experience.
Absolutely. I mean, when you think of roller coasters and, you know, and extreme thrill rides in general, like drop rides, they're manipulating and commodifying primal fears.
What are drop rides?
Well, basically, where you get, you know, strapped to a chair and you go up a 400-foot tower and then you drop down that tower.
Oh, my God, that's right. Yes, I have seen those. I've seen the videos of people's faces, cameras that are in those when they... They're screaming and
never
crying
very flattering.
For their mothers.
Never very flattering. That's actually an interesting point that I mentioned in the video, in the documentary I'm pondering. Why do people call out for God on these rides when they're not actually religious? I mean, they inspire primal responses because they're preying on and commodifying primal instincts. Primal instincts that, you know, are good. When you're on top of a tower, you shouldn't drop off the tower, but that's actually what you're paying to experience because you can't get that, and you obviously have some sort of primal need for it in everyday life. So in actual fact, you know, because we live in this lazy consumerist society, I love to point out things when people get snappy at me for saying that, like, oh, why would you say that? And by the way, I include myself in that. I'm not trying to, you know, act like I'm...
You're lazy and consumerist.
I'm not trying to act like I'm not lazy and consumerist. We binge watch Netflix shows and we think that's boastworthy. And the thing that always blows my mind, we pay to simulate manual labor by going to the gym, right? That's what the gym actually is. Uh-huh. So that says...
So instead of going out into the field and harvesting some wheat, uh-huh. we're down on the treadmill or on the, what are those things called? The striders.
Yeah. Other evil things. We're paying to simulate the manual labor that we don't have. So, I mean, we since the Industrial Revolution, the world has changed enormously and we haven't. We're the same twitchy cavemen that we always were.
Or and, women. Cave women.
Oh, cave people, sorry.
Yeah.
Should be more PC, with the same twitchy cave people that we always were, and yet now we live in this lazy consumerist society, and we have to pay for the privilege of accessing these primal instincts, these primal emotions that you can get on thrill rides. And one of the interesting things about them is they generate what's called a peak experience, and a peak experience is a psychological term, and it's essentially when you've achieved something profound and you're in the zone and everything is right and everything is perfect and, you know, your chemicals are going off in your brain. These thrill rides can actually create that sensation in you. And this is the same experience if you went and climbed Everest. The biological and physiological experience in terms of, you know, the chemicals that are going off in your brain are basically the same. So some people are saying, well, you're a loser if you get that on a ride because that's a cheap thrill. What you need to do is have a more earned thrill, which is climbing Everest or, you know, doing something like that. The reality is we don't have time to, you know, have these wonderful visions of, oh, we're going to run across America or we're going to climb Everest or do something incredibly lofty. We're not. We're actually not because it's incredibly expensive. It takes an enormous amount of time. What are you going to say to your boss? Hey, I'll back in 6 months. I'm just going to go and climb Everest. And in really lofty pursuits like Everest, you'll probably die. The end result is this peak experience, which you can get a biologically comparable sensation by dropping $90 and going on this thrill ride. So there's
$90. Did you say?
Disney's just gone up to, I think, $125 US. I mean, this is substantial amounts of money, and yet people still pay because we need them.
Because we actually need this kind of pressure release valve in our lazy lives.
Absolutely.
Yeah. We're talking on Life Matters with Malcolm Burt. As you can hear, he's a roller coaster enthusiast, but also an academic. And he's a video producer, has just made a documentary about roller coasters. It's called Signature Attraction, the way that roller coasters are often the big piece, the big top name, the big bill name in a theme park. Now, Malcolm, how did you come to have this interest? It goes back to childhood?
It goes back to childhood, and it's kind of a sad story, so, you know, get your tissues out. I was a fat, gay nerd living in rural Queensland, and I was getting bullied at school. I mean, I'm older now, I can admit it. And I saw these parks that were, you know, distant down on the Gold Coast from where I lived, as being a refuge because they're promoted as magical places. They're literally promoted as escapes from the everyday. And I thought, if I could just go there, I could find people who were like me, I could connect, and at the same time, I could get near these magnificent roller coasters, which are, you know, they're spectacular. They're visually spectacular. You know, they're signature attractions. You can see them from the highway. The sound, you know, and ultimately, if I could get on one of those rides, then I would finally have something to boast about. That's actually where it started.
Mm. And your family got the kind of golden ticket at some point, like in the Charlie and the Chocolate Factory, the golden ticket into the chocolate factory. Your family won a day pass.
I won the day pass, yes.
What happened?
There was a competition to redraw this my now home parks, mascot's car, and so I chose the roller coaster. So I drew this crazy hot rod version of the roller coaster and stuck the mascot in it, and I won, and I was very excited about it because finally I was going to get there. I was actually going to, you know, I was going to finally go to the place that I thought I'd be happy, basically. And we couldn't go. And in the film, I actually challenged my parents. Why couldn't we go? And they can't remember. They say that, you know, they may have been sick or, you know, there may have been some work thing, or it may have been a bad boy. That's actually what they say. So, you know, I had the golden ticket in my hands and I couldn't go. And it was actually, you know, one of those moments. It was a bit of a moment. But on my birthday a couple of years later, after whinging endlessly, we finally went. And it was perfect. It was just a perfect day where everything is as you expect it to be, and it's it was just beautiful. It was just wonderful to go there. And, you know, unfortunately, I was too scared to go on the Big Coaster the first time I went there.
Yeah, right. So in a way, all this, like a magnifying glass, it sort of it intensified your fascination.
Absolutely. I mean, I still, even though I was too scared to go on the Big Coaster at the time, I watched it for hours, torturing my parents, next time, let it go around one more time, I'll totally go on it the next time. And of course I didn't, but I've since caught up.
Mm. And now you've been all around the world and been on roller coasters everywhere. Tell us, you know, what's your favourite? What's the scariest?
I mean, to be honest, I find drop rides scarier than coasters. Mm-hmm. I think there's a very sensible reason to not get on a drop ride, but I keep doing it. But in terms of the coasters that give me enormous thrills, probably Top Thrill Dragster in Ohio, at Cedar Point in Ohio. It's a launch coaster, meaning you go from stationary to, I think it's 190 kilometres an hour in less than 4 seconds, and then you go up a 420-foot tower.
Is that legal? I mean,
apparently, maybe in that state.
Surely, I can just feel like, you know, a chiropractor listening to that, thinking, "My goodness, that could be lucrative."
Yeah. You go up a 420-foot tower, and then you spin around and come back down again, and then it stops. And it's just an enormous blast. And everything about this ride is psychologically incredible because it's gigantic. You can see it from miles away, and then all day when you think about getting on it, it's working on you. And you can hear it launching, and you know you're scared, and then you finally get on it. And I was actually on with a friend of mine who's this big tough bloke from Chicago. And right before we got on it, I was like, "Are your hands shaking as much as mine?" No, my hands are shaking more than yours. So I mean, it's designed to intimidate you, and it does its job. But I have absolutely encouraged people to look that up on the web and check out the videos.
Okay, Top Thrill Dragster at Cedar Park in
Cedar Point
in Ohio. I can see actually that the weight is part of the build up to the excitement. Mm. What about this thing called CoasterCon? What's that?
CoasterCon is the... Actually, let me just take one step back. There's something really interesting about the weight, and then I'll definitely talk about CoasterCon.
Tell us about the weight.
There's been some interesting research in the UK, I think it's the University of Nottingham, where they wired people up, you know, for blood pressure and respiration and sweat and all that sort of stuff, to get on a roller coaster. And they basically sort of mapped out where they thought the people were going to be scared, you know, what was expected versus what actually happened. And what they discovered was everyone was off the charts in the queue.
Uh-huh. Right.
Isn't that fascinating?
Well, it actually does remind me of that technique that Adolf Hitler used by making people wait for so long to before he arrived at the rallies. Like, he'd arrive 2 hours later, by which time the crowds were in this sort of fervour. I guess it's and used a tried and true technique. Yep,
absolutely. That's psychological conditioning. I mean, you're in a fight or flight mode where, you know, which is simply described as you going, "Will I get on this? Will I not get on this?" And then when you finally get on it, you move to a different state. You move to a fight state, and your data basically goes down because you are fighting the coaster. Mm. Unfortunately, there's not much you can do.
Yeah, I see. So tell us about CoasterCon. That's where all the absolute roller nuts show
absolutely
up.
CoasterCon is the annual gathering of the American coaster enthusiasts, which is actually a huge group in the US, and they descend on a couple of parks for a few days and get together and, you know, bond and you know, go on lots of rides, and it's quite marvelous. I went on it in 2013, and we're going back this year, so it's very exciting to be around lots of other similar people. But I tend to place myself as a moderate enthusiast. A lot of people would not, but it's true, because some of the enthusiasts in American coaster enthusiasts, for example, there's this one gentleman who used to make beautiful, detailed coaster sculptures, and he made so many of them that he decided to move his family into the garage so he could make more.
That's
kind of hardcore, right?
Yeah, you found your place.
I did.
And you're in the lower ranks of the roller coaster nuts.
I'd like to think so.
It's a fascinating field of research, and thank you so much for sharing not only the research but your enthusiasm for roller coasters with us today.
Thank you very much.
That's Malcolm Burt, and you've got to have a look at his documentary, Signature Attraction. We'll put a link to it on the Life Matters program page. In a moment, we're going to hear about a very special anniversary today. Mm-hmm. Well, the game of football has come a long way since the days my next guest pulled on his boots, boots with steel-capped toes that wouldn't be allowed anywhere near a football field today. Ted Smith is a former Socceroo, although they weren't called that in those days. He played for the Olympic football team at the 1956 Olympics in Melbourne, and this weekend he's part of the centenary celebrations for the oldest serving club in Victoria, Moreland City FC. It's a fair bet that Ted will be named in Moreland's team of the century, a big bash tonight to mark the club's 100th season. Good morning, Ted. I gather you've just wound up with your weekly coffee and catch up with your mates.
Yes, we've solved all the world problems.
Good to hear it. So a big year for your old club, Ted.
Yes, it is. And when you realise that the leading clubs in the 50s and 60s have all disappeared, and Moreland, combining with Coburg and Park Rangers, have now gone from strength to strength. At one stage I was a bit nervous about whether they would survive, but they've bounced back and they're going forward.
So a big night, about 400 guests, and a lot of the old boys are coming. And you reckon you'll get into this team of the century?
I can't know that. One of the difficulties of this project is that you have three clubs, you have differing periods and differing levels of achievement in those clubs, and it was impossible if you just selected a particular team, say the 1957 Moreland team, it just wouldn't properly represent all the players. I think there's over 3,000 have played through those.
I think you're being a bit humble there. Now, tell us what you began playing round ball very early on. You'd left school at 14 and you were playing. What was it like then? I mean, we know it was called in the past wog ball, unfortunately.
Yes, well, one of the big differences is that when I was playing even at junior ranks, all of my teammates were English, Scottish, Maltese, Polish or whatever. I was the only Australian-born player. And that also happened at Moreland, at South Melbourne Hellas, who had all Greek imports, and Hakao had Scottish and English imports. And now if you look at the number of over a million registered players, and boys and girls from the age of six getting involved with the game and getting good coaching, it's chalk and cheese. It's taken longer than we'd hoped for, but the upward graph is amazing.
So you played, and as we've said, you were at the Olympics with the likes of Betty Cuthbert and Shirley Strickland, Murray Rose, Dawn Fraser. Do you think that, well, obviously the game has changed incredibly. What's the biggest change that you've seen?
The biggest change I would think is that if we take 56 as an example, football or soccer was always way out in left field, given very little support, very little media attention. And one of the first things that struck me when we first went into the Olympic Village, football was accepted as the same as every other sport. And we enjoyed the company of everybody. We had the same facilities. But when that was over, very little had changed outside. But if you look now, the coverage, the respect for the game from other sporting people is enormous.
Mm, yeah, there's a million people playing the game in Australia now. And one of them is your grandson.
Yes, my grandson started at six at Moreland. And when my daughter asked where he should play after I was kicking around in the backyard, I said, well, I don't know what the Moreland setup is. When we played, we didn't have a junior team. Now they have over 200 kids, and they're turning you away because there's no more room.
Well, that must really warm the cockles of your heart. Congratulations, Ted, and have a great night tonight. Ted Smith, he's 80 years old, been playing with the club since the 50s, and 100 years old, the Moreland City FC. What a proud tradition. Thanks for your company. Next time on Life Matters, you'll find Ellen Fanning, and I'll be back Thursdays and Fridays. See you then.